clad in a white robe and sporting a pageboy haircut, the front man delivered cryptic instructions in a monotone over a bed of ambient noise. "See the glazed eyes, and know the warmth of the hip-deaf goddess." The band kicked into a lazy, hypnotic groove as a rail-thin 18-year-old named Barbara Hudson approached the mic to sing the lines written by her bandmate Ian Bruce Douglas, creating a kaleidoscopic portrait of the titular deity. Like a New England Nico, Hudson sang about the illusion of reality and how she was the mysterious girl of your dreams. "We didn't like the name that much, but they had a certain chemistry," Perrett says. Ian Bruce Douglas was well-spoken, talented. The rest of the group was a bunch of hicks from the Cape. That night, Amphion found its first band. At 16, Ian Bruce Douglas Wise enrolled at Berklee School of Music in Boston on a Downbeat magazine scholarship, but soon transferred to the University of Virginia. In Virginia, Ian started to write music, inspired by Dylan and Richard Farina, whose performances back in Boston had made a deep impression on him. Suicidal, he left school and moved back to his parents' house on Cape Cod, where his band Underground Cinema was born. After seeing the band at the Unicorn, Jenks reached out to a man named Alan Lorber, whom he had met through a friendship with Lorber's brother. Lorber was a successful New York producer and arranger of a mainstream kind. Think Brill Building, not Haight Ashbury. He'd later boast that his previous hits had garnered $50 million in record sales and that he was by Phil Spector's side when The Wall of Sound was born. In his varied career, he had once written a handful of songs with Brooks Arthur, future engineer of the Astral Week Sessions. Lorber agreed to check out the Boston band. Dressed in jacket and tie, Lorber was impressed by their live show, but like Perrette, he didn't care for the name either. Bruce Douglas and Lorber arrived at a verbal agreement that night at the Unicorn. Could anything be done about the name? The singer had an idea. A few months earlier, he had obtained some pure LSD and had taken a solo trip alone in his bedroom. "I started looking at myself in the mirror, and my face was doing funny things," Bruce Douglas recalled. "I had a bunch of colored markers I used to draw with. I grabbed a green one and started drawing all these psychedelic designs on my face. When I was done, I looked at myself and said, 'Whoa, I am Ultimate Spinach. Ultimate Spinach is me.'" Bruce Douglas was Ultimate Spinach, and Ultimate Spinach was him, sure, but altogether he, Lorber, Perrette, Jenks, and the Hicks from Cape Cod would work together to formulate the sound heard round the world. All they needed now was a record label. Bruce Arnold and Jack McInnes were booked at the Carousel on Cape Cod for a string of gigs, performing as the Villagers. The owner had offered to let them sleep over in the restaurant. During the day, Arnold and McInnes were expected to fill in as short order cooks. At night, they'd shower off and perform live music for the patrons. When they were excused from their daytime duties for consistently burned burgers, they also lost a place to bed down. The Villagers didn't mind sleeping on the beach as long as it wasn't raining. By 1967, the Villagers were playing Boston venues like Club 47 and the Unicorn, and had won Best Folk Duo in Broadside of Boston's Reader Poll. Arnold once played a show with Jim Queskin's jug band before it disbanded. "I know this sounds odd," Arnold says, "but Mel Lyman was sitting in a lotus position, upside down. He didn't say a word the whole time he was in there, and of course, people have said that he ascended, that he was one of the ascended masters." Run-ins with possible ascended masters aside, the energy at folk shows was dwindling. Friends advised Arnold and McInnes to form a British invasion-style band. But Bruce Arnold wasn't interested in mimicking English hitmakers. "I wanted it to be a new, modern American music," Arnold says. They added Eric Gullickson on second guitar and found a drummer in Harry Sandler, who cut his teeth with a surf rock outfit called the Mods. The new lineup immediately caused a stir. Over a period of 2 days, we talked to 9 different record companies, and every one of them offered us some sort of a deal, Arnold recalled. One suitor, producer and songwriter Wes Farrell, liked their earthy, surging Can't Find the Time in particular. Write more songs like that, he instructed. On the ride home, the band landed on a name. Orpheus, the poet and musician in Greek mythology who traveled into hell to save his wife Eurydice. Back in Boston, Amphion told the band that Alan Lorber wanted to audition them right away. We showed up the next day, and upon completing our set, Alan presented us with contracts, Bruce Arnold recalls. We were told that MGM would be putting up $250,000 to market us. That sum was accurate, but it turned out that the money would be spread out among all of the Boston bands included in the ad campaign. Drummer Harry Sandler remembers an immediate kinship with Lorber, something they weren't feeling with anyone they auditioned for in New York. We're going to work together on making Orpheus into a great pop group, Lorber told them confidently as they signed. He set up the band in a suite at the Park Sheraton across the street from Carnegie Hall in New York while they recorded their debut. In the studio, Lorber would have Bruce Arnold sit down next to him at the piano and play through the Orpheus songs on guitar. Arnold recalled, I would play the chords, and he would go find each note, and then, not only, to my delight, did he take care to use that exact chord I had discovered on the guitar, but also he had a name for it. That's not a B minor, that's a B minor 11th with a double flatted third, Lorber would say to an impressed Arnold. Lorber's main strength was arranging, and much more than any of the other Boston sound bands, Orpheus is where his arranging talents had room to flourish. When it came time to record members of the New York Philharmonic on top of Orpheus's basic tracks, Lorber didn't want the whole band at the sessions. While at the hotel, I would get confidential telegrams from Alan asking me to come to the studio to hear mixes or work on arrangements, says Arnold, who strategically remained in New York after his bandmates went back to Boston. Arnold had to tell a white lie to quell the others' suspicion, but hey, it was worth it to see orchestra members perform his compositions, right? Today, Boston's Beacon Street is a vision of immaculate brownstones with astronomical price tags. But in the mid-60s, it was a reasonably priced location to set up your kid while he or she attended Emerson or BU. Beacon Street was the epicenter of the college scene, Dick Weisberg says, explaining his band's name. Beacon Street Union followed up a series of successful local gigs, including opening for Jerry Lee Lewis and backing up Chuck Berry with a trip to New York. After a show at Steve Paul's Scene on West 46th Street, they met producer Wes Farrell. Like Lorber, he was a seasoned industry hand. He had composed Hang On Sloopy with Burt Burns and penned the theme to the 1966 monster flick Gamera the Invincible. Walking into the scene, Farrell bowled over the Beacon Street Union with his silk suit and Frankie Avalon hairdo. Over meals at Manhattan's fanciest restaurants, Farrell would order for the whole table while telling the boys he was looking for bands who had fresh material and knew how to play in the contemporary style. Back in Boston, word got around quickly. Weisberg remembers the hallucinations, Peter Wolfe asking if they had indeed signed with Farrell to make a record. Weisberg asked if there was something sketchy about Farrell, but it wasn't that. You can't make a good record if you haven't paid your dues, Wolfe said. The first thing you hear when you put on the eyes of the Beacon Street Union is a voice intoning with horror movie gravitas. Look into the land of the prophet. Look past the living streets of Boston. Look finally into the eyes of the Beacon Street Union. This faux profound Bay State poetry was written by a Boston College friend of the band's and mailed to Wes Farrell while he was mixing the album in New York. They were intended as the liner notes, but for some reason Farrell put Tom Wilson in the vocal booth and had him read. Wilson was most famous for producing Bob Dylan's first electric album and his breakout hit, Like a Rolling Stone. His orchestral overdubs on Simon and Garfunkel's The Sounds of Silence helped turn the forgotten song into a number one radio hit in 1966. And although Andy Warhol is credited as producer of The Velvet Underground and Nico in 1967, it was Wilson who was in the studio shaping the band's beautiful, dark, twisted fantasy. But his pedigree didn't lessen the Beacon Street Union's horror as the needle worked through the opening salvo. We finally get our hands on the album, and we can't wait to hear, like, what it sounds like, drummer Dick Weisberg says. All of a sudden, this spooky voice comes on and starts reading the liner notes. Our first reaction was, this is not cool. This is not cool at all. Even so, tracks like Sadie Said No and Mystic Morning can still mesmerize half a century later. It's by no means the train wreck that Weisberg implies, though you can understand his annoyance. We were like this counterculture weird thing that Farrell experimented with, but he did it his way, not ours. The band was embarrassed and started to get on each other's cases. It was a bad thing. The initial reviews of the three Boston Sound albums were positive. Broadside covered them all in early 1968. The Eyes of the Beacon Street Union is a fine album which makes it good listening. And Orpheus possessed the magic that separates great from orgasmic. The eponymous Ultimate Spinach LP, hailed as the most unique of the bunch, overflows with ingenuity and humor. But like the Beacon Streeters, the Spinach frontman wasn't thrilled with how the producer took control, mixing the album without consulting him. He never was interested in my vision of these songs, Bruce Douglas complained. With all the grace and style of a bull in a china shop, he slapped those albums together. Almost as bad, in the liner notes, Alan Lorber heaped praise on Alan Lorber. This first Ultimate Spinach LP is a result of the creative genius of producer Alan Lorber. The ever-changing fabric of sound and unique concept of the album is a high point in the Lorber career, which has been dotted with numerous successes. To this day, Bruce Douglas will often still sarcastically refer to Lorber as the creative genius. With the January 29, 1968 Newsweek, the Boston Sound hit the national radar, acquiring a spelling variation that would stick. At first, only the names seem changed, the article begins. The scene is right from San Francisco as the psychedelic blobs assault the nerves and the raucous music hounds the dancers crowded hip-to-hippie in squirming abandon. Instead of the Jefferson Airplane or the Grateful Dead, the music is by Ultimate Spinach, Earth Opera, Fluff and Butter, and instead of the Fillmore Auditorium, the scene is in the cavernous psychedelic supermarket, the catacombs, or the Boston Tea Party. The place, astonishingly, of this latest outbreak in the pop revolution, is puritanical Boston. What has happened is more than just a new rock word, Bosstown. By February 1968, everyone under 30 in Boston had an opinion on the article and the bands named therein. The Boston Globe tirelessly covered the topic, noting gamely, if stiffly, "What has happened is a pop explosion with our beloved old Beantown square in the middle." More bands were forming practically overnight. Puff, Quill, Ill Wind, the Improper Bostonians, the Apple Pie Motherhood Band, Eden's Children, Fluff, A Warm Puppy, Bead Game, Bo Grumpus, Listening, Butter, the Cambridge Electric Opera Company, the Ford Theater, One, the Freeborn, the Orphans, Cambridge Concept of Timothy Clover, Fort Mudge Memorial Dump, Groundspeed, good times. By the time writer Richard Goldstein arrived from New York on assignment from Vogue, everyone knew that the word is out. Boston is in. His lengthy feature sways between praise and fair criticism. Fledgling Boston groups have been signed, sealed, and delivered like birthday candygrams. These musicians know that the record industry has selected Boston to be the Florence of American rock. Sometimes, explained a public relations man, you can make something happen by pushing hard enough. And the push is definitely on. MGM president Mort Nassiter gets scholarly about it, remarking, "Some of this music is so intellectual that it is a little like the poet T.S. Eliot, with his seven layers of ambiguity in each line." Next, Goldstein sets his journalistic focus on a fascinating new Bosstown group named Earth Opera. There's actually a much stronger underground situation here than in Frisco, precisely because Boston is one of the most uptight cities in America, singer Peter Rowan explained to the Vogue writer. Rowan, 25, was already a music veteran, having recorded his first song as part of the Cupids at age 14. Gravitating toward bluegrass music, in 1963 he started playing mandolin for legendary picker Bill Monroe. Rowan moved to Nashville to play guitar in Monroe's Bluegrass Boys. He recalls watching Dylan bang out most of Blonde on Blonde during that Tennessee residency. "We worked on the big repertoire night after night, playing the Grand Ole Opry and stuff like that," Rowan recalls. "Monroe saw me getting too close to his style, so he used to stand behind me on stage and shout at me, 'Sing it like Pete Rowan. Tell him it's Pete Rowan.'" Back in Boston, Rowan took Monroe's advice. He formed Earth Opera with David Grisman, and they proceeded to make some of the strangest music to be associated with the Bosstown sound, flavored with dramatic lyrics, inventively sparse arrangements, and prog rock leanings, most memorably on the genre-hopping enigma entitled "The Red Sox Are Winning." Today, Rowan is a soft-spoken, practicing Buddhist, and he recalls that era with a smile. In 1967, he and Grisman first began working on songs that he thought of as bluegrass slowed down, performing them at Club 47 and elsewhere. At one gig, he came upon Mel Lyman backstage, soaking his harmonicas in a jar of liquid, a common practice to get a richer tone from a blues harp. When Rowan asked what was in the jar, Lyman said it was LSD. He laughs at the recollection. The scary thing is, he could have been telling me the truth. But neither the developing rock scene nor the strange community forming up on Fort Hill piqued Rowan's interest. Instead, he holed up in Brookline with Grisman, perfecting their slow arpeggiated music. Elektra Records signed Earth Opera, who defied all their advice on how their debut record should sound. To the label's credit, they let us form a band, put us up in L.A., and let us figure out what the fuck we were doing. The self-titled debut's mix of styles was distinctive enough in itself, but out of all the Boston sound acts, Rowan's lyrics stand alone in directly addressing the Vietnam War. The lead-off song, "The Red Sox Are Winning," was no feel-good sports anthem, but instead a damning indictment of a city that would rather celebrate a baseball team than protest a generation of young men dying in a foreign war. Inside a fragmented collage-style song structure, the singer embodies the apathy he saw in the people of Boston in the summer of 1967. "Should I turn off the TV or go to the racetrack?" The Red Sox were, in fact, winning. Rowan wrote the song in the middle of the season baseball fans would come to call the impossible dream, where the team climbed out of a 9-year slump, clinching the American League pennant. "I thought I picked up on the vibe pretty good at that time," Rowan says. That was the summer when the Red Sox were winning, but the gloom and doom of the whole Vietnam thing. Rowan pauses, before mentioning a childhood friend who went to fight and didn't return. Rowan was proud to express his anger on record. I had a platform. I could say what I wanted. I was sympathizing with the warriors who had gone to Vietnam. The Red Sox are winning ends with the sound of an audience going rabid at Fenway as an announcer goes berserk. Let's make Boston America's number one baseball city. Kill the hippies! Kill the hippies! Earth Opera wasn't the only Boston sound band affected by the Red Sox' miraculous 1967 season. Dick Weisberg remembers a multi-night string of Beacon Street Union gigs at the Rathskeller in Kenmore Square, right next to Fenway Park. They had made a giant plywood sign that the club manager let them lean against the front, saying, "Now appearing, Beacon Street Union, album coming this January." The drummer was home watching the news when he saw the 8-foot sign being carried through Kenmore Square by ecstatic Red Sox fans. Then they smashed it to pieces. Elektra sent Earth Opera on tour with The Doors in the spring of 1968. Jim Morrison would frequently be MIA moments before their scheduled time, and Earth Opera would be asked to extend their set. It warped Rowan's mind. "You're in front of an audience that wants to see a freak show," he says. It's not that Jim himself was a freak so much, but that he knew how to touch that freak aspect in people. The Great American Eagle Tragedy, Earth Opera's follow-up, doubled down on the anti-war sentiment. The title track is a 10-minute opus that ends with Rowan shredding his vocal cords, screaming, "I can't stand it anymore!" After a long tour that unceremoniously ended in Huntington Beach, California, the band broke up in front of Rowan's eyes. "We had no idea what the Boss Town sound was," he adds. As the Boston sound ads and promotion rolled out, Ultimate Spinach commenced their first tour in San Francisco, playing the Fillmore 2 weekends in a row. They now featured a second female singer, Priscilla DiDonato, an occasional cartoonist for Broadside, to match the layered sound on their recorded debut. Amphion's Perrette says Ian Bruce Douglas became an egomaniac, especially after he saw all the promotions. But they were a good live band. Bruce Douglas said that his bandmates turned against him on subsequent tours, claiming he caught wind of plans to accidentally attack him with a guitar in the middle of a show. He was still having disagreements with Lorber as well, who wanted to market us as G-rated psychedelic bubblegum, and never forgave the group for acting like feedback-happy Mad Acid Hatters on the Pat Boone show. Over in the Beacon Street Union camp, the guys had lobbied their colleges for a year off in order to tour behind their major label debut. Their first show was on February 5th in Detroit's Grand Ballroom. The owner of the venue gave a tour, proudly pointing out bullet holes from the previous summer's riots. The opening act was the hometown MC5. "We get an endorsement deal from Custom Amplifiers, because we're MGM recording artists now," drummer Dick Weisberg recalls. "The only problem was, all the new gear was gonna meet us in Detroit when we got there." The band found the new equipment bewildering, perhaps explaining why they lost control over their usual tight live show that first night. A shriek from Tartachny's amp brought the guitarist to his knees, as though he'd been knifed in the skull. In Los Angeles, MGM Records threw a release party. But no one in Beacon Street Union was of drinking age yet, so the musicians had to stay in another room adjacent to the one with full bar service. Occasionally, an executive would pop his head in to congratulate them. "It just kept getting weirder and weirder," Weisberg says. When the band played the following night, the crowd filled up with identical-looking waifs with floral wreaths on their heads, many carrying violin cases. Weisberg felt like he was in a Fellini movie. Meanwhile, Orpheus was getting significant radio play, first with "I've Never Seen Love Like This," followed by the soft rock precursor "Can't Find the Time," which peaked at number 80 on Billboard's Hot 100. With their mellow strumathons and harmonizing, it's hard to imagine Orpheus opening for The Who, Led Zeppelin, and Cream. But they held their own, even without the orchestral sounds that enhanced their debut record. Orpheus was doing well in Boston and New York, in Bakersfield, California, in Hawaii, and that was about it, as those were the only places that were carrying the record in stores. Orpheus didn't know it, but MGM hadn't paid the pressing plant, and according to Arnold, was basically going into bankruptcy at the time. The band was ecstatic when they were named number 10 in the 1968 Playboy Jazz and Pop Reader Poll, between Hendrix and the Beatles, but were disillusioned to learn it was due to voter fraud. "We went into every magazine store in New York City, and we posed as being from Playboy," an industry insider eventually explained to Arnold. "We told them that there was a typographical error on the ballot in this month's issue, and we were going to take all of them, and that new ballots would be in the next issue." After collecting thousands of ballots, they wrote Orpheus on every single one of them, mailed them to multiple locations around the country, and then had them mailed to Playboy from those outposts. It's unclear if Alan Lorber knew this poll was rigged or not, but he would later cite the group's position on the Playboy list as proof that the critics had been wrong all along, and that audiences across the country adored them. It got stranger. A friend of Arnold's returned from a visit to California with a few of the region's best underground newspapers. He pointed out an ad for a band called Orpheus, set to appear live in San Francisco later that week. Orpheus, the band Arnold had founded, had never played and were not scheduled to play anywhere on the West Coast. The ad used the same distinctive font that adorned their album cover. The night of the San Francisco performance, his friend called the club and asked to speak to someone in the band. "Hey man, I'm so glad Orpheus is playing there tonight," Arnold's friend said to the musician at the club. "Are you the same Orpheus who does that song, Can't Find the Time?"
"Yeah, that's us," the young man happily answered.
Bruce Arnold was beyond bewildered.
Why was there another Orpheus? When he confronted Alan Lorber, the producer denied having anything to do with it.
The country is now looking toward the East Coast because flower music is dying, Beacon Street Union drummer Dick Weisberg told New England Teen Scene, a comment all too typical of the scene. With so many Boston Sound musicians putting down the opposite side of the continent, it comes as no surprise that the first major piece of criticism about the scene came from the West Coast. The real surprise is that they found a local to pull the trigger. John Landau is best known as the music critic who saw Bruce Springsteen perform in a club in Cambridge, wrote that he had seen the future of rock and roll, and soon found himself to be the boss's manager. But the lesser-known fact is that John Landau, born in Lexington, site of the original shot heard round the world, was right there at the birth of rock criticism. In January 1966, Paul Williams published the inaugural issue of Crawdaddy, which the New York Times later called the first magazine to take rock and roll seriously. Landau tore through it cover to cover, thinking, "I can do better than this." If Williams sounds familiar, it's because he was also a follower of Mel Lyman, the editor's eventual rejection of and escape from the Fort Hill community is the first thing described in David Felton's 1971 expose. "I was overcome with the vibrations emanating from Cambridge's folk revival," Landau wrote of his Lexington upbringing. "I started going to the Boston clubs, especially the old Club 47, as often as school and parents would allow. During a good week, it wouldn't be surprising to see Eric Von Schmidt, Rolf Kahn, Tom Rush, Jeff Muldaur, Bobby Neuwirth, Jim Queskin, the Charles River Valley Boys, Bill Keith, and Jim Rooney all up on stage at one point or another." In his first Crawdaddy piece, Landau eulogizes the Remains.
They were how you told a stranger about rock and roll. His byline graces the debut issue of Rolling Stone in November 1967. By April 1968, the Boston Sound had incited such a heavy press cycle that Rolling Stone wanted it for the cover. Who better to get the facts right than a Bay Stater? Landau was no fan of the West Coast's musical output, having gone on record that the San Francisco shit corrupted the purity of the rock that I loved, and I could have led a crusade against it. But the first target for his lance would be home. Under the headline, The Sound of Boston, Kerplop, Landau wrote, "The very real problem that Boston faces at the moment is that the hype may boomerang and hurt what has been a slowly developing situation. The first wave of albums is likely to give Boston a black eye with people genuinely interested in music." The piece retraced what happened in Boston and Cambridge in the previous 5 years, explaining the rise and fall of the folk scene, as well as mid-60s garage rock bands such as The Lost, whom he considered far superior to anything the city has now. Though Landau was harshly critical of Lorber's grand scene scheme, the article is largely informational, with the headline and captions doing most of the name-calling. Paul Revere is shamed, Bosstown sound a dud. He highlighted the nightclubs and underground newspapers that made the scene more vibrant, pointing out that Avatar's struggles with censorship had only made the papers stronger. Nonetheless, he concluded, one good club and two publications don't make a scene. The final word in the piece went to Jim Queskin, who declared that geography is irrelevant, and that there is no Bosstown sound. The next time Queskin was quoted in the pages of Rolling Stone, he'd be explaining why he broke up his band to follow Mel Lyman. In hindsight, Landau admits that he might have been too rough on some of the musicians, and that the whole debacle wasn't their fault. But most of all, he remembers Queskin's talent. He was the best damn performer. You almost can't imagine how good he was, says the man who discovered Springsteen. And Mel was great. Then Avatar arrived, and I couldn't put the two things together. The real Boston sound, Landau adds, was Club 47 at the height of its existence. Per Landau, it was true that The Lost had broken up before the Boston sound went national, but the members of the band were all connected to this new development. In fact, every single member of The Lost appeared in one or more Boston sound bands. Lost bassist Walter Powers even auditioned to be a member of Van Morrison's band, losing the spot to Berkeley's Tom Kilbanya. Lost singer Ted Myers had watched some of his wildest dreams come true in the mid-60s. In 1965, his band was signed to Capitol Records and toured with the Beach Boys. The following year, he married his girlfriend, Eve. One advertisement for the band in 1965 declared, "Five Americans from Boston, making the most British sound heard since the Tea Party." But botched distribution, recalled 45s, and substance use hampered their momentum, and in 1967, Myers announced the band was over. For Myers, keeping his marriage together with his wife Eve proved to be just as hard as unifying his rock band. "We would break up every 2 or 3 months and ultimately get back together again," Myers explained. He had never been up to Fort Hill before, but when she joined up with Mel Lyman for a few days, he finally drove up there to get her back. Lyman wasn't around, but Myers found the place unsettling, with what looked like a dozen or more Lyman wives and children milling about the houses on Fort Avenue Terrace. Eve gladly left with him. Relocating to New York, Myers did a double take as his hometown suddenly exploded in the press as the chosen new music industry ground zero. Since Alan Lorber was now looking to Ray Perrette at Amphion for Boston musician recommendations, it was only a matter of time before Perrette connected his old friend Myers with Lorber. He offered me a publishing deal, which provided a small weekly stipend, Myers recalls. The $75 a week was enough for him to live on. Lorber said he would make an album with Myers if he put a band together. Thus was born Chameleon Church. Personnel included his former Lost bandmate Kyle Garahan, co-songwriter and bass player Tony Skerrin, and on the drums, future Saturday Night Live star Chevy Chase. They met in the fall of 63 at the funeral of a mutual friend who had died in a motorcycle accident during Myers' first semester at Goddard College. Chase was eager to join the new band. He was sort of straighter than us, Kyle Garahan remembers, but soon enough he became a freak. Remember the Boston sound? Chase once asked a reporter. Really heavy on violins. Lorber sorted through all of Myers' new compositions, either declaring them suitable for recording or throwing them in the trash. Lorber was not an easy person to deal with, Myers says. For instance, he insisted the singer change the line, "Kids on a bench getting high," to "Kids on a bench getting by," which Myers unsuccessfully protested as not making a lick of sense. He was a suit, guitarist Garahan says of Lorber. Suits are suits. Before the photo shoot for the back cover, the image-conscious Myers took the band clothes shopping. They decided on long Edwardian morning coats. Chevy's had a Nehru collar and looked like it was made out of brocaded upholstery fabric, he writes. In one of the few public comments Chevy Chase has ever made about Chameleon Church, to music writer Steve Simmels, Chase goes beyond uncharitable. He's downright offensive. They wore faggy little suits, they wrote faggy little songs, and they were all junkies, and they're probably dead. The band recorded their basic tracks in New York, after which Lorber assured Myers that he'd be looped in for the orchestral overdubs and mixing. But a few weeks later, the producer told him it was finished. "Don't complain until you've heard it," Lorber said, calling it the best work I've ever done. The musicians huddled around Myers' turntable and put the acetate test pressing on. "What we heard made us all physically ill," Myers wrote in his memoir. "There were weird, repeating echo effects and backwards envelopes, Lorber's idea of psychedelic effects. To us, it just sounded like mush." Lukewarm reviews greeted Chameleon Church, radio ignored it, and so did MGM. Amphion's Perrette convinced the band that if they relocated to Boston, he could get them live gigs. They played three shows to little fanfare, the last of which was at a high school football stadium in Waltham. At one point, Chase walked to the front of the stage and started a filthy improv as the band vamped. The last sermon from Chameleon Church. After the band's brief run, Alan Lorber suggested guitarist Kyle Garahan go solo. Garahan agreed and recorded a single, an original titled Shame. Lorber set him up with a booking agent who casually mentioned, "You know, if you got a full band together, you could go do some of Orpheus's gigs." The agent explained that sometimes other bands would learn a few Orpheus songs and tour regions that the actual band was too busy to hit. Initially repelled by the offer, Garahan came around. The booking agent assured him that the real Orpheus knew about it. Garahan recruited Chevy Chase and a few other musicians, learned how to play the breakout single Can't Find the Time, and hopped in a van. This band shows up for these gigs looking nothing like Orpheus, sounding nothing like Orpheus, and doing zero Orpheus tunes except that one-hit single, Garahan says. Chase remembered performing in a gym at the University of Kentucky when people started to notice. "You're not Orpheus," an audience member screamed. "Yes, we are," Chase yelled back. These escalating audience encounters got back to the booking agent, and the fake Southern U.S. Orpheus sham was over after just a few gigs. Later, when Bruce Arnold from Orpheus figured out what happened, it made a lot of sense to him why their booking agent only had the band tour the East Coast. There were Orpheus clones to cover the rest of the country. To this day, Arnold isn't certain how many fake versions of his band were on tour in the late 60s. A month after Rolling Stone covered the Boston Sound, a Wall Street Journal feature printed dollar figures and marketing tactics so baldly that it seemed designed to turn a rock and roll fan off music forever. MGM sells each Ultimate Spinach album to the distributor for $2.03. The retail list price is $4.79. It gives 49 cents of this to producer Alan Lorber, who gives an undisclosed share of this to performers. Ed Abramson, however, the new manager for Ultimate Spinach and Orpheus, makes the article's most repellent remark. Abramson was Alan Lorber's accountant and head of a nascent artist management company called International Career Consultants. He explained to the Journal how he was enjoying his newfound power over the band's creative instincts. Ian Bruce Douglas has a conception in his mind that anything he wants to say or do is fine. My job is to control that aspect. I had a meeting with him recently. It had to do with his overall attitude. On solos, for example, Ian might feel he wants to take a guitar solo and go on forever. I tell him he has to limit himself. It doesn't get any cooler than accountants telling musicians how long their guitar solo should be, does it? These articles and others were enough to overboil the outraged underground press, Lorber noted. He was likely referring in part to Avatar. Ken Emerson, a Harvard student who frequently wrote about music for the paper, started commenting on the Boston Sound in Avatar in late March 1968. Up until then, non-MGM Boston bands were bending over backward to associate themselves as part of the so-called sound. Apple Pie Motherhood Band's 1968 debut on Atlantic, for instance, declares on the back cover that the band hails from Boston. They made their first impact on the pop scene in Bosstown, and they've been spreading the gospel of the Boston Sound throughout the length and breadth of the East Coast and the Midwest. Now, though, bands were becoming far less enthusiastic. Rusty Marcus, bassist for Eden's Children, shared his grim point of view with Avatar. "Just look at Boston," Marcus said. "Look at the colors, gray, brown, black. Everything's dirty, even the sky. In San Francisco, there are pinks, whites, and yellows. Boston could never support a music scene. You can't enjoy yourself if your body's sick. And Boston's sick, physically, psychologically sick. We're glad we're not lumped together with the rest of the Boston Sound," he concluded. "I mean, MGM's trying to buy its way on the charts." Ian Bruce Douglas escalated his ego-fueled reign of terror. He hired Carol Lee Britt to replace Priscilla Di Donato and immediately began to pressure her to drop LSD with him. At a show in Central Park, the Spinach singer went berserk, throwing a piano bench on stage that nearly knocked Britt over. Behold and See, the second album by Ultimate Spinach, arrived in August. Britt was already gone. It stalled at number 198 on the Billboard chart. Spinach must now abandon its eclecticism, Broadside of Boston wrote in its review. They must stop borrowing indiscriminately and develop and do their own thing, or else they will find that whatever they do will really be nothing at all. Bruce Douglas seemed to agree. "I fired myself," he recalled, though his bandmates remember it the other way around. They last saw him in September 1968, going down the lift at the Amphion Management Building, shouting obscenities up the elevator shaft. An Ian-less Ultimate Spinach was of little consequence to Lorber, who built an entirely new lineup around remaining original member Barbara Hudson, almost instantly after Ian's departure. He still had Ted Myers and Tony Skerrin of the defunct Chameleon Church under contract, so he installed the pair as the new leaders of Ultimate Spinach. It felt weird, Myers says. For the first time, he had no say in the personnel. The songs Tony and I wrote were not remotely like the rather bombastic stuff that Ian had written, so it was, for all intents and purposes, a whole other band. Myers thought the album should be called A New Leaf, a clever nod to the big spinach leaf that graced the cover of the first LP. But in their infinite wisdom, Myers writes in his memoir, Lorber and MGM Records decided to simply call the album Ultimate Spinach, which was the same title as the first album. Maybe they were hoping that people would buy this one by mistake. During the subsequent tour, no one seemed to notice Ian wasn't in Ultimate Spinach anymore. I guess my counterfeit spinach fared better, Myers says, in regard to the faux Orpheus. After the Spinach tour, most of the new lineup was caught in a Back Bay drug raid. Myers took it as his cue to split. His wife Eve had just run off again all the way to California, and he decided to chase her down one last time. Akin to the faux Spinach LP, the Lyman family too released a record around this time whose origins were dubious. If you take the cover at face value, Love Comes Tumbling Down, Reprise 6353, is a record by, deep breath, American Avatar, the Lyman family with Lisa Kindred. The front cover shows Lyman in profile, standing in front of a gorgeous sunset on Fort Hill. The band name unfurls in a Tolkien-esque font designed by Eben Given. But that's not the real title of this LP, which Reprise Records, a Warner subsidiary, released in 1969. It's actually supposed to be Kindred Spirits, an album that blues singer Lisa Kindred made for Vanguard in 1964. The Lyman family stole it, renamed it, repackaged it, and resold it to a major record label, which in turn released it, oblivious to its origin. David Good, the Lyman family member and Vanguard engineer on the project, explained what happened to David Felton in 1971. Kindred had a Vanguard contract, and Mel, an old friend, asked if he could back her up. Lisa loved Melvin, and she said sure. The band featured Fort Hill community members Lyman, Queskin, and Terry Bernhard, as well as Bruce Langhorne, a musician whose predilection for playing a giant wagon wheel tambourine inspired Bob Dylan to write a song about him. Good's boss at Vanguard didn't like the results. He thought the harmonica was too loud, there was too much Melvin and not enough Lisa. In the end, Lyman had Good steal the master tapes, thereby ending his employment at the record company. Then the guru of Fort Hill sat on the tapes for years. At that time, there was no such thing as the Lyman family, Lisa Kindred told Felton. At that time, it was still my album. Upon seeing the record for the first time, Kindred exclaimed, I know Mel is an Aries with a god complex, but this is too much. Everyone who performs on the album is listed inside the gatefold with their astrological sign printed next to their name. Lyman wrote the sententious liner notes. The force that drew us together to record this music is the same force that is always evidenced in great works of art. And like all great works of art, this music was created to elevate men. We were merely the instruments. This kind of note might have been appropriate if it were one of the greatest recordings of all time. As it stands, it's a pleasant-sounding blues record with loudly mixed harmonica all over it. I ended up being a sideman on my own album, Kindred lamented. The name of the record isn't the only fiction here. The intimidating photo of the Fort Hill community on the back cover, showing 22 family members arrayed in front of the tower, is in its own way false, too. Amid the crowd, one person in the back row sticks out. For one, he's the only person smiling. And even more strikingly, he's the only African-American in the entire group. But look a little closer and you'll notice something strange. His shoulder seems to defy the rules of physics and exists, partially, on top of the person next to him. It almost seems as if he's been pasted into the group photo. It turns out the community had provided the same exact photo for an earlier Globe article about the commune. That time, though, the smiling man wasn't there. Someone had cut and pasted him into the group shot used for the album sleeve. Why would they do this? Was it an ill-advised attempt at faking racial diversity? Was this their way of taunting the community around Fort Hill, whose neighborhood they invaded in 1966? Why, from stolen tapes to inserted man, would they do any of this? In hindsight, Dick Weisberg agrees that Peter Wolfe was right. The Beacon Street Union hadn't paid their dues yet when they scored a record deal in 1967. And in a cruel twist of fate, now that they had paid their dues, listeners labeled them a cookie-cutter product of MGM. Producer Wes Farrell promised that their second album, The Clown Died in Marvin Gardens, would put them back on track. But it tanked. Original members quit. The band tried to reform as the Eagles. Wes Farrell said they should call it the Silver Eagles. They settled on Eagle, releasing one album that no one heard. There were times in the next few years when they couldn't get a booking as Eagle, so they'd revert to their old Beacon Street Union name to score a gig. Out of the three original Boston Sound bands, Orpheus was the least affected by the negative press and record company schemes, like fake versions of their band or music reader poll ballot stuffing. Maybe that's what they had in mind when they titled their second album, Ascending. For singer Bruce Arnold, the only downside to their growing fame in New England was the way locals pronounced the band name, Orpheus. Arnold's private belief that he was Orpheus and that the rest of the guys were simply his backing band was becoming harder to conceal. Tensions rose. Harry Sandler's showy live drumming was getting a lot of attention. Jack McInnes was doing a lot of drinking. After a sold-out show at Arlington High School in December 1969, a full-blown screaming match erupted in the dressing room. "Are we a band? Or are we just your sidemen?" Sandler fumed. Arnold didn't have to say it out loud. McInnes and Sandler quit that night. In classic Alan Lorber fashion, a changing lineup wasn't a problem, as long as the band name could still be capitalized upon. Orpheus continued to release new music, but the first two albums undoubtedly represent their commercial peak. If you want to find out if Harry Sandler and Bruce Arnold eventually buried the hatchet, you don't need to look very far to get your answer. There's an Orpheus website where Bruce Arnold's name and likeness are conspicuously removed from all photographs and the band's biography. Stranger still, the website states that it was done at Arnold's request. In the summer of 1969, Fusion magazine's Robert Soma published a cover story about what went wrong with the Boston Sound. Two balloons depict the scene in 68 and 69, with the latter completely deflated and flaccid. In the fall of 1970, 25-year-old Michael Kerb became president of MGM Records. On his first day, he fired the entire A&R staff. Kerb was just getting started. In November, he announced he was going to rid the label of any act that sang about hard drugs or promoted heavy substance use. Kerb dropped 18 bands, describing how the alleged miscreants wipe out your secretary, waste the time of your promotion people, abuse the people in your organization, show no concern in the recording studio, abuse the equipment, and then to top things off, they break up. President Richard Nixon praised Kerb, stating, Your forthright stand against drug abuse is a responsible contribution to the welfare of your country. The young record exec denied the policy could turn into a witch hunt, magnanimously assuring Billboard readers that MGM wouldn't be making the specific list of dropped bands public. The bands, of course, knew. They suddenly no longer had record contracts. Bruce Arnold, from Orpheus, now operating the band with an entirely new lineup, was shocked to learn that his innocuous act was part of the druggy MGM 18. "I had to think back what lyric it could possibly be," Arnold says. "Then I remembered. Baby, I remember when we turned on to a rainy day from I've Never Seen Love Like This." The track was actually about getting turned on to a rainy day, cannabis optional. To this day, Arnold believes if the band had actually been busted for drugs, they would have been a lot more popular. When Curb was asked to comment on the Boston sound, he dismissed his own label's recent back catalog as just a bunch of junk. Things got worse at the label. In 1972, MGM's Lenny Scheer, who had been instrumental in the marketing of the Boston sound, was indicted for tax evasion related to unreported income he made by selling returned unsold LPs from stores to discount houses and pocketing a portion for himself. Later that year, an MGM executive leaked stories to syndicated columnist Jack Anderson, who ran an ongoing investigation on payola in the music business. For the first time since the early 60s, the FCC started paying attention again. In 1975, a series of federal indictments ensnared everyone from low-level private record sellers like Bang Records associate Carmine Wassel DeNoia to big shots like Clive Davis, the president of CBS Records. Clive Davis was fired and legally fined $10,000 but given no prison time. DeNoia was convicted in 1976. The party was over. Polydor absorbed MGM Records in 1976. Alan Lorber later trademarked the titles Boston Sound and Boss Town Sound, just in case. I'm in a tiny Cambridge club called Toad to see a local band, Fandango, do their regular Wednesday night slot. The packed room brims with joy, the crowd dancing as the band rips through a repertoire of classic soul covers. Fred Griffith, the 74-year-old lead singer, belts out a version of Ernie Cado's A Certain Girl, as if he were half a century younger, looking for love. Afterward, we talk in his camper van across the street. Griffith was one of three lead singers in The Bagatelle, the only band associated with the Boston sound to feature black performers. He'd been recruited by Lee Mason, ex-drummer for The Lost, to join a large soul band he was assembling. The Bagatelle ballooned into a 9-person outfit featuring 3 African-American singers trading off on lead vocals and backing each other up with tight harmonies. Opening for national acts like Richie Havens and the Peanut Butter Conspiracy, the band earned a reputation for putting on a hot live show, occasionally literally incorporating the talents of a fire-eating mime. In Rolling Stone, Landau raved about their hip kind of soul music, judging them the best performing band in the city. The Bagatelle landed a deal with ABC Records. Tom Wilson, fresh from his surprise Beacon Street Union incantation, was on board to produce. He promised the Bagatelle they would figure out how to make it happen together, Griffith says. We went in the studio, recorded it, and next thing we knew, you know, they had put it out with strings and blah, blah, blah. We never got to say a word about what happened. At one point, to test if Wilson was paying more attention to their music or the model sitting on his lap, the mighty Bagatelle horn section purposely played off-key during a take. "Great guys," Wilson said, simultaneously flirting with women in the control room. "It's great." 11 p.m. Saturday arrived in the early summer of 1968. One review optimistically predicted that the album ought to do a lot to wipe out the bad taste of the Boston sound. The Bagatelle hit the road. 9 men, 2 vans. Despite the critical praise, tempers were already running high by the time the band arrived in Chicago for an August show. Just as the Democratic National Convention